Hi everyone, and welcome to 4Panel, the Geek Show's dedicated comic book, manga, graphic novel, graphic literature, graphic everything podcast. My name's Rob, and joining me today is the amazing, the ever wonderful Andrew.
Hello.
How are you today?
Oh, I'm very something.
Something is better than nothing.
Yep. Well, you know how you mentioned we are dedicated to all things graphic.
Are you graphic today?
No, but the news is graphic.
Oh, is this the kind of graphic that requires pixelation?
Well, and I realise I'm booking convention by actually going straight into the news. But this is something that just popped up on my Twitter feed. So there's a comic book that DC are doing at the moment called Batman White Knight, which is written and drawn by Sean Gordon Murphy.
Okay.
And the idea is that it's kind of set in a parallel world where sort of the Joker has reformed and he's now Gotham's greatest hero, fighting against Batman, who I think's become kind of a fascist ruling Gotham with an iron fist.
Okay.
Anyway, that's not important. Well, what is important is this tweet from Sean Gordon Murphy. Batman White Knight will be DC's first black label imprint, which means, wait for it, first nude Joker Harley love scene! Exclamation mark. Exclamation mark. Exclamation mark.
Oh, no.
So that's going to be in a real comic book.
Oh.
Published by DC Comics.
Oh. I mean, the cringeworthy sex scenes I thought we got rid of when we stopped Frank Miller writing any more Batman.
No, apparently they're back. God, this is... They've topped Batman and Black Canary doing it on a dock full of burning people.
Yeah. I don't know what to say to this, Andrew. Except, if anyone puts it in front of me, it literally will be my eyes. And my eyes are bad enough as it is. You know, you've seen me.
I know. I mean, I have enough trouble with occasionally remembering just the idea that Joker and Harley Quinn have sex as a concept.
Well, don't forget, I've started developing presbyopia, which means I have to, you know, I have to take my glasses off to read stuff normally because my glasses don't work for reading now. So that means
I think you need your glasses on when you're reading this. Then,
yeah, I was planning to, because otherwise I'd have the page right in my face, and that's far too close.
Oh. I don't want to see this, Rob.
I don't want to see it. What's the betting that DC are going to send it to us now?
Oh, please don't, DC. I think what makes it worse is just how excited Sean Gordon Murphy is.
Oh, God, no. Doesn't that then suggest that he is a fan fiction writer? A Harley Joker fan fiction writer?
Oh, he is. He's one of those.
This DC, Marvel, all of you comic book publishers, stop doing this. Okay.
I have to look up Sean Gordon Murphy now to see if he's got the word damaged tattooed across his head.
Oh, please don't. If his Joker looks at Jared Leto, then, oh, I'm going to hold it in, Rob.
Yep, that was Senator Gordon Murphy that I accidentally Googled for. Sean has an A in it.
Oh, can you imagine, though, if it was actually Senator Gordon Murphy writing this? Oh, welcome to the world of the bizarre.
Okay, nope, I can't find a picture, so my only recourse is to assume that, yes, he is just Jared Leto.
Sean Gordon Murphy. I've not actually heard of him, though. I mean, do we not have any kind of information on what other comics he's worked on or anything like that?
I mean, we probably do. What do you think I knew? I'd get this stuff before. Well, I know he did the art for Chrononauts. Remember that Mark Millar thing I covered a while ago?
Oh.
It was a comic by Mark Millar, so it was a not very well fleshed out movie pitch. But he does do nice art.
I think I found him. He's worked on Batman, Scarecrow, Year One, Teen Titans, Hellblazer, City of Demons, Shaun of the Dead, Joe the Barbarian, American Vampire, Survival of the Fittest, Punk Rock Jesus, The Wake, and Tokyo Ghost.
Oh, there's a picture of him. Yeah, he looks like the kind of guy who gets excited by drawing a naked Harley Quinn Joker sex scene.
I don't know what to say.
Gonna be so pasty, Rob.
I know.
Hey, so news of people being horrible. Quick bit of more news about Stan Lee's just whole crazy situation.
Yeah.
He's now got a restraining order against his business manager, Kia Morgan.
Oh?
Morgan is the guy who's been accused of committing elder abuse.
Oh, and that person.
Yeah, and I think this probably backs it up, because the request says that Morgan has put Lee's personal well-being at risk by isolating him from loved ones, using what they call undue influence, and that apparently has included basically taking over Stanley's Twitter handle and even moving him out of his mansion into just some random condo.
Why would you move him out of his mansion?
Because you're a bad man.
Yeah, this person should not be anywhere near Stanley, and I'm not going to encourage any kind of violence, though. I don't think we should. I think the court should handle this in the correct way.
Yeah, and hopefully now with that order in place, that's the end of all that unpleasantness.
Hopefully, because, I mean, he's had a hell of a time, with his wife passing away last year.
Yeah, it just seems like ever since Joan Lee died, just everything's gone a bit horrible for him.
Yeah, and I really feel sorry for him, and he deserves so much better.
Yeah, he does. I hope he gets it now.
So do I. So, yeah, that put a downer on things, didn't it?
That did. Let's pick things back up with... Hey, Marvel, they're bringing some comics back.
Are they?
Yeah, so in what a move that I don't think I've really heard of happening for quite a few years now, Marvel are resurrecting some of their cancelled series. So Unstoppable Wasp and Iceman are coming back.
Iceman's coming back?
Yeah, and apparently they're going to be written by the same people. So Unstoppable Wasp by Jeremy Whitley and Iceman by Cena Grace. But with new artists, Guri Hiru, who did the art on Gwenpool, they're going to be doing Unstoppable Wasp now. And Iceman is going to have Nate Stockman on art, who I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah, Bob, you've been reading Iceman, and you've been enjoying it, if I recall.
Yeah, I mean, Iceman's one of those ones where I honestly didn't think I was going to enjoy it, but it's been better than I actually imagined it would be. I thought it was going to be one of those typical ones where they take the character as an individual character, and then they basically just have them going off and basically fighting loads of things and having adventures, blah, 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 blah. But this is actually a lot more down to earth. This is basically, he's older, he's wiser, he has a younger version of himself who's just trying to come to terms with the fact that he's in another world, he's, you know, he's gay, and he's just realizing that he's gay.
Yes, that's right. That most down-to-earth of storylines of having a time-displaced younger version of ourselves from maybe the 60s show up.
Well, this is the thing. The younger version of himself doesn't really play a big part in the story. It's like a little kind of... It's more of a cameo kind of thing. But what I like about it is the effect of that has on the older Bobby Drake. The fact that he's actually looking more to settle down. He's looking for more stability in his life. He wants something more from his life than what he's got. Even though what he's got sounds amazing to a lot of people, you know? And I like the fact that he's juggling now. He's basically trying to find some kind of balance between, you know, what he wants and, you know, what people want from him.
That's good. And stuff of a Wasp I'm less excited for.
Oh, this is the Unstoppable Wasp with What's-Her-Face from the Red Room, who decided to form a girls' club that no boys were allowed.
Yeah, Nadia Pym.
Yeah, that no boys were allowed in, unless they were called Jarvis.
Yeah, it's one of those things I've been thinking for a long while, why I didn't like it. And I think a lot of it has to do with possibly sort of... I think I'd like it if it was written by a woman.
Yeah.
Like, if it was actually about someone saying... Hi, as a woman, I've had a tough time breaking into this industry, so I'm going to write a comic that reflects some of that.
Yeah, I do actually get what you're saying there.
Yeah, but because it's written by a straight white male, it's a bit like a lot of the sort of liberal guilt things I see on Twitter, where it's basically someone bringing up an issue, not necessarily because they're that invested in it, but more just to show, look at me, I'm not one of the bad ones. Everyone like me.
Yeah, basically. The thing is, when I was reading it, I was enjoying the first couple of issues of Unstoppable Wasp. I thought the first couple of issues were interesting. You know, they were fun. There was something rambunctious about them. And we were, if I remember rightly, we were coming off the back of it really enjoying Mockingbird as well, weren't we?
Yeah. And I think that might be part of it as well. Is that, like, we've had Mockingbird, we've had Hellcat, we've had Moon Girl.
Yeah.
Like, they all star these kind of similar intelligent and plucky ladies.
Yeah. Although
it just seems like a bit of an also-ran.
Yeah, exactly. Although I have to say, in the case of Patsy Walker, you know, plucky, definitely. Intelligent.
She's emotionally intelligent, Rob.
I love the version of Jubilee in Patsy Walker, though. Okay, I think the version of Jubilee in Patsy Walker is amazing.
Yes, I think that was like the brief moment where I actually liked the fact that Jubilee was a vampire.
Yeah, where she's just standing in the alleyway saying, what was it, Son of Satan, I'll bite you, and pointing at her fang.
Actually, I really like Jubilee in Generation X as well.
Yeah, she's not too bad in Generation X, I've got to say.
You know what, I'm going to say it, Rob. I've gone from being a Jubi skeptic to a believer.
Are you a Jubilieber?
I am a Jubilieber.
Okay, I'm not going to say anything else.
It's okay, we've done some solid pun work, we can move on.
Yes.
Movie news. We now know some more details about the Wonder Woman sequel.
Okay.
Apparently, it's going to be called Wonder Woman 1984. Guess what year it's going to be set in?
1979.
You got it, Rob.
And is she
going to... They can't trick you.
And is she going to spin round in a circle to transform into her uniform?
Yeah, you know, I was going to say no, but I wouldn't put it past them to, like, have some kind of gag about that.
Yes, because it is supposed to be set in 1984. And let's be fair, the Wonder Woman TV series was still popular in 1984.
I hope Gal Gadot has, like, a massive perm.
Oh, what if they have the Wonder Woman TV series on the TVs in 1984 and Gal Gadot's like, why have they stolen my life? Well, I didn't do any of this.
I mean, part of me wants to say, but Rob, that doesn't fit in with the canon of the DCEU. But then also, God, who cares about the canon of the DCEU?
Yeah, the canon of the DCEU had General Zod turning into Doomsday.
More like Poops Day, am I right?
No, Poops Day was definitely Green Lantern.
Yeah, it was. Oh, poo cloud. But it's okay, because that movie canonically didn't happen.
Oh, because Deadpool took it out, didn't he?
He fixed it. Yes. It's all okay now.
So, that's how Deadpool saved the universe.
Yeah, back to Wonder Woman. So the villain, as we know, is going to be Cheetah, played by Kristen Wiig. That's still so weird.
Right.
Kristen Wiig is a weird choice.
To play Cheetah?
Yeah. Although I guess if, like, she's Barbara Minerva and she's, like, kind of sort of nerdy and bookish, I can see that.
Yeah, I can see that, but... As
and then I guess Cheetah's probably going to be more like CGI.
Or they're going to do an Incredible Hulk TV series where you have Bill Bixby, but then you have Lou Ferrigno, who's just been painted green. Please
yes,
do that.
Lou Ferrigno is coming back as Cheetah.
No, no, just have like some female bodybuilder and just, you know, paint spots on her.
I've had the best idea.
Oh?
Starring Kristen Wiig as Barbara Ann Minerva and Janelle Monáe. As Cheetah.
Yes. Yes. This works. I'm happy with this.
Because, like, that is a woman who definitely owns a leopard print bodysuit.
And if not, would be happy to have leopard print painted onto her.
I think we've made a great film, Rob.
Yes, so do I. I think that late 1970s, early 1980s television has a lot that we should thank them for.
Although, here's something we might not be thanking them for.
Oh.
Or maybe we will be. I don't know. I just wanted to bring the conversation back around, and this was the only way I could think to do with it. Apparently Steve Trevor's going to be back.
So, Steve Trevor, the guy who was in a plane that exploded in the sky, which gave Diana the strength to fight Ares because of his noble sacrifice, which embiggens the smallest man, somehow survived that and is in 1984.
And also the same age, and now, according to like the one official photo, standing in a mall, dressed in, quite frankly, an incredible moss green tracksuit.
Has he been frozen in ice all this time?
What if he has? What if this is how the DC movies introduce America Mando? The thinly veiled Captain America ripoff?
Yes.
Or General Glory, the other thinly veiled Captain America ripoff? Or the ultra-nationalist, the third very obvious Captain America ripoff.
Who sounds more like a clan member. See, the first two I was fine with.
I don't like where the theme of this episode is going, Rob.
All I'm saying is the first two I could understand. You know, General Glory is a great name. But, you know, when you start saying ultra-nationalist...
I mean, is General Glory a great name, though, Rob?
It's a great pun name, is what I'm saying.
Because, I mean, there's really only one thing you can call your secret hideout when your name is General Glory.
You're the one...
And we're a classy show, so we're not going to say what it is.
You're a bad, bad man. Oh, he's going to have missiles in that secret base as well, isn't he?
And a nice sliding pole.
Oh, no, no.
So, Rob, what do you think about Steve Trevor coming back?
I'm confused as to why he's still the same age as he was at the end of the... let's see, which war was it again?
It's World War One.
Yeah, and now he's in 1984.
Like 1918 or something when he blew up.
Yeah, so, and he's in 1984 now. So that means he's the same age as he was 66 years of bloody hell. It is Captain America.
But yeah, I guess it just assumes what's really going on. You know, he might not necessarily be back. It might be like, I don't know, a hallucination or something.
She's going to hallucinate Steve Trevor in the middle of a mall in 1984.
Wearing a tracksuit.
Yeah. Or maybe it's the descendant of Steve Trevor, who's also called Steve Trevor. But how did Steve Trevor have descendants? He never had a wife. Or maybe...
I don't know. He seemed like a bit of a lad.
Maybe they cloned him.
Oh, I don't know. He's a nephew or something.
He could be an alien. An alien symbiont who's taken the form of Steve Trevor.
Did you say alien symbiont?
I was thinking more John Carpenter's The Thing.
Yeah, God knows.
We don't know. Shall we move on?
Yeah, I just hope he's not like back.
Oh, God, no. Move on.
Yep, moving on, but sticking with DC films. So, a Green Lantern Corps movie is maybe actually going to happen.
Okay.
I mean, it's still on the list of DC films that are definitely, absolutely going to get written. You know, like Batman, that also maybe doesn't exist and doesn't, or does stop Ben Affleck. And the Joker movie. And the other Joker movie. And Cyborg. And Flashpoint.
Well, I would have put Cyborg after Flashpoint because, you know, as we've already established thanks to Justice League, Cyborg is more of an afterthought.
You're right. Right, I should have finished that list and then yelled out, oh, no, wait, and Cyborg.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, Rob, I've let you down.
No, you didn't let me down, don't worry. We'd leave that job to DC. Sorry, I'm bashing DC, I know, but...
Yeah, because we say that, but, like, to be fair, this one sounds like it could be pretty cool.
Okay.
Because it's actually going to be written by Geoff Johns, who has done, like, a ton of Green Lantern stuff.
He knows his Green Lantern, I know that.
Yeah, like, he's basically the one who made it into one of DC's top properties.
Okay, when we're talking about Geoff Johns' Green Lantern, which Green Lanterns are we talking about? Cause...
Well, apparently the film is going to feature Hal Jordan and Jon Stewart.
Okay, so it's not going to have, is it Kyle Rayner?
Yeah, no, I guess not Kyle Rayner.
And it's definitely not going to have Guy Gardner.
I kind of hope it does have Guy Gardner, though.
Because I really want a Guy Gardner movie. 90s Guy Gardner. Do that, DC. If you're going to do a movie that is just kind of, that panders to Donald Trump.
We are not going to have, like, weird Guy Gardner covered in tattoos and can turn his arm into a bazooka.
No, what we're going to have is a superhero for the Donald Trump supporters.
That's the worst idea. You're not having good ideas tonight, Rob.
I think it's an amazing idea. It'll tank all over the world.
See, I think I'd rather have a good Green Lantern movie.
Yeah, but the thing is, if you do it the way they did Guy Gardner when he quit the Green Lantern Corps and went and literally stole Sinestro's yellow ring and became a Yellow Lantern, and then realised why Sinestro at that point kept fighting Green Lanterns, because according to the canon as it was then, the only way Sinestro could power up his ring was from the green energy given off by the Green Lantern rings. So he kept having to pick fights with Green Lanterns in order to keep his ring charged, which sounds wrong now that I actually say it out loud.
What planet are you on tonight, Rob?
That is the little truth. That is the literal truth. That was how Sinestro was powering his ring at the time. That's absolutely true. That's in the Guy Gardner comics as well. I know it sounds bizarre. It sounds strange. Even I found it a bit weird. But yeah, Hal Jordan, Jon Stewart, it's a good combo.
It is indeed.
Geoff Johns writing it, though, that's a bit of a score, isn't it?
Yeah, that's going to be cool if it is good. Yeah. And it will not be cool if it is bad.
Yeah, but I mean, it's his reputation on the line, so I'm hoping it is good. You know, on the balance of probabilities, it's going to be good in terms of the writing anyway.
It would be a good Hal Jordan, John Stewart.
Well, I know that Nathan Fillion is probably going to get summoned as the first person to be Hal Jordan, although I think maybe not this time.
Oh, yeah, I think he's probably a bit too old now.
Yeah, and when he did all that Captain Hammer stuff, yeah, then, you know, and when he was doing Firefly, around then, that would have been perfect. But now, I don't know. I don't know who I'd have playing. Do you know who?
The problem with Hal Jordan is you just need some kind of generic Brett Chiseljaw type.
Yeah, but you know, I'd like to see Jamie Foxx playing John Stewart.
Is that because Jamie Foxx is incredibly cool?
Yes, and also I've just got a mental image of Jamie Foxx doing the Green Lantern North. I reckon he'd do it in a really good way. Or have Jamie Foxx playing the role of John Stewart, but have someone like Samuel L. Jackson doing the voiceover and, you know, the Green Lantern Oath, because Samuel L. Jackson probably does the Green Lantern Oath like a badass.
What if Samuel L. Jackson is just a member of the Green Lantern Corps in this?
I'd be fine with this. And since he got away with having a purple lightsaber in Star Wars, you know he's going to have a purple ring or something.
But see, there's already purple lanterns.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe he's got like two rings. He's got a purple one and a green one, so he can be a member of both corps because he's a badass.
What if he just has one on each finger?
What, like the Mandarin?
Yes.
Are you saying Samuel L. Jackson is the Mandarin? Because that just sounds like the best supervillain blaxploitation movie of all time.
I don't know. Does that make the Mandarin more or less racist?
I don't know. But it does sound like a proper 1970s superhero blaxploitation movie, doesn't it?
Also, what if Samuel L. Jackson is the Mandarin, but also he still has, like, the Fu Manchu moustache?
Okay, now we're heading into big trouble in Little China territory.
But you say that like that's a bad thing.
No, it's not.
So I think, in essence, what we're saying is Hal Jordan should just be played by Kurt Russell, but use that fancy de-aging technology they use in Guardians 2.
Yeah, I'm fine with this, actually.
Oh man, but no. Kurt Russell should be Guy Gardner.
That's an idea.
Because, like, he is the abrasive, hard-drinking guy.
So what if you had Kurt Russell as Guy Gardner? You have, who would you pick? Jamie Foxx, still? Sticking with Jamie Foxx, are we?
See, I don't know. My problem with Jamie Foxx is I feel like he's almost too cool to be Jon Stewart.
What about Cuba Gooding Jr.?
That could work.
I know. It's a bizarre thought. You know, it's a bizarre thought, but if you think about it, he's got the moves, you know.
But also, what about Mahershala Ali?
Yes. Yes. Oh,
it's quite frankly,
yes.
Cage, if you're going to get rid of him after half a series.
Yeah.
You deserve to lose him to DC.
Suit him up. I'm sold. I'm sold already. You don't need to say any more than that. I'm sold. He's perfect. So, a de-aged Kurt Russell as Guy Gardner.
Yeah. I mean, it does mean Green Lantern Corps is going to cost literally like a small nation's GDP to create.
Yeah.
But it's worth it, damn it.
But this is, again, another bizarre thought. But I thought, what if we just went the whole hog then and made Hal Jordan Sylvester Stallone, because then you can have Tango and Cash together again.
Tango and Cash 2. Tango and Cash in space. And also Mahershala Ali is here because he's rad.
Yeah, that thought's not going to leave you now, is it?
It's not. I'm sorry, everyone. We've accidentally made the best film. All the other films can quit now and go home. They're not needed.
No. Oh. So shall we move on that, since we've triumphed over films once again?
Yeah, in fact, I think this is probably a good place to take a break.
Okay.
This is Lizzie Boyle and Connor Boyle of Disconnected Press, and you're listening to The Geek Show.
Ah, there really is nothing like a first leather-bound edition of a classic Victorian podcast. Hello. We're literally loitering from The Geek Show, and we cover literally all types of books, from hardbacks to paperbacks to sometimes the words within them. If any of these things interest you, why not pop in and give us a visit on Literary Loitering.
So yeah, all of our shows are available on Apple Podcasts, Audioboom, and iTunes, and our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can find us on Facebook or on our own Twitter, which is Andrew
at Four Panel Podcast.
Or you can email us direct on studio@thegeekshow.co.uk.
If you really love cosplay and you like to get dressed up as your favourite characters from TV and movies, whatever it is that you like to dress as, get yourselves down to Geek Corner in Stockton-on-Tees in the Regency West Mall. We actually make cosplay props and costuming props. They're generally made from foam and stuff, so they're perfectly safe to have out in the public. So, come along.
And welcome back to the show. Now we're going to be talking about what we've been reading. So, Rob, that.
Yes. So, I'm going to give you the choice. You have the choice of Venom or Venom.
I choose Nemov.
I have Nemov. I don't have Nemov. So we'll start off with the...
That's the secret identity of Crob Eddie.
Ah, since you said Crob Eddie, I'm going to have to start off with Venom Inc. then.
Sure, why not?
Right, Venom Inc. is confusing because of its title, because it has Venom Incorporated. And so when I saw the title, I thought, this has something to do with business, I assume. And I expected, when I turned the pages, to see Eddie Brock dressed as Venom in a suit with a tie going to a business meeting, since it is supposed to be Venom Incorporated.
Right, and you don't mean like Eddie Brock, but the symbiote is forming a suit. You mean he is Venom, but with a suit over the 7-foot hulking slobbery mess?
Yes.
Actually, that reminds me, there was a great comic I read a little while ago.
Oh?
It was like from the 90s or something, I forget the name. But it basically starts with Venom in prison, where he has set up the prison newspaper. And it's just like Venom towering over a tiny typewriter, just like bashing away on the keys.
See, that sounds like that bit from 90s Hulk, where he's writing and the pencil just looks like a little match in his hands.
But anyway, that's what I want out of the Venom movie.
Yes, that Venom is good Venom. This doesn't start off with Eddie Brock. In fact, it starts off with some character called Mania, who is currently wearing the symbiote, and is swinging through the streets of a city, which may or may not be Philadelphia, I'm not sure.
It is Philadelphia, because she's actually the sidekick of when Flash Thompson was Venom.
Yeah.
And what she wears is an offshoot of the Venom symbiote that was possessed by a demon for a bit.
Yeah. So
comics are a bit weird sometimes.
Yes. Anyway, her symbiote is kidnapped.
Symbiote.
I don't care. The symbiote is kidnapped or symbiote napped by a team of villains, one of whom wants to try the symbiote on, and may or may not have history with symbiotes in general. Anyway, Flash Thompson is basically acting as Mania's coach, teaching her how to be a hero. In this version of the story, he's basically former military, and he's basically a war hero, yada, yada, yada. Introduced Peter Parker as Spider-Man. There's lots of shenanigans going on. Black Cat is fighting for control of the underworld. Eddie Brock is trying to get his symbiote back still, and has formed this stuff which can get rid of symbiotes. But Flash Thompson turns up, and it ends up in this weird fight between Eddie and Flash over control of the symbiote, who basically loves both of them and can't decide between the two of them. So there's like goop and tentacles everywhere. Eddie just wants Daddy and Daddy to stop fighting. And, like I said, goop and tentacles everywhere. So,
you know, I really want a Venom story where just, like, Eddie, Flash and the symbiote go out for ice cream.
Well, yeah, I want that now as well. But anyway, this goop or whatever it is that doctor has made, this Dr. Steve, he's made this astrobiological serum, which in small doses regulates the hormonal output of the symbiote and interrupts its ability to do stuff. And so Peter Parker, in his genius, drops this entire vat of this liquid all over Eddie and Flash. And somehow that turns Eddie's symbiote, it causes it to remove itself from Eddie and just basically be dormant on the floor. Flash, on the other hand, somehow turns into anti-venom.
Okay. Why not?
Yeah, which wouldn't... Well, he's basically like a palette-swapped Venom. Who looks a bit like... He looks a bit like Deathstroke as well, or Deadpool. Kind of a mercenary-type anti-Venom
character. It's basically like what he looked like when he was Venom, with all like the military gear and the armor and stuff.
Yeah.
Now he's white instead of black.
Yeah, now he's white instead of black. And that was just kind of... I was just looking at that and going, talk about timing. Because on the very next page, you have a bunch of villains who are basically getting venomized and controlled by some evil guy who's turning them all into his army. Isn't it convenient that Flash has been turned into anti-Venom so he can help fight against these, you know, this horde of Venoms that are coming to get them and take them away? Ha ha, they're coming to take them away, hee hee. Anyway, Eddie finds that he still has some kind of connection to Venoms because he can hear them. He's not mad, you know, he's been tested. Everything goes pear-shaped, Eddie gets a symbiote, yada, yada, yada. Big fight, big brouhaha. That's not the bit that confused me. The bit that confused me was right at the end, and I was left scratching my head when I found out that Peter Parker is somehow in a relationship with Mockingbird.
Yeah, I think that happened at some point during the Spider-Man series when I wasn't reading it.
Yeah, and I was just kind of... Because, well, the symbiote that they left trapped in her bathroom has trashed her bathroom, so obviously she's not too happy, and she tells Peter he's going to get his own place. But I was just really surprised by the fact that they had a relationship in the first place, because...
I mean, you can do better than that, Bobby.
Yeah.
Also, I'm going to level with you. You've said the word Venom and symbiote a lot, and I have no idea what this story is about.
It's about a crime boss who tries to take over the city by using, the underworld of the city by using the symbiote and an army of offshoots who he controls.
And it's okay, great. That's fine then.
And it's up to Anti-Venom and Eddie Brock Venom and Black Cat, who was venomized at one point but is now better and relies on her luck, and Spider-Man to save the city from this giant creep who basically absorbs everything and becomes a giant Hulk Venom type character. And then, Mania turns up and starts hitting him with these Hellfire Blasts or whatever because she still has powers of a demon.
Comics are weird.
You're not wrong there. Tune in 10 minutes for more Venom.
Okay, but providing us a brief respite from the Venom is Runaways, Find Your Way Home, which is the first volume of the new series, written by Rainbow Rowell and with art by Chris Anker.
Okay.
So... this is basically a sequel to whenever the last Runaways series was, I want to say maybe 2010 or something.
Yeah.
Anyway, it doesn't really matter. This is set kind of 2 years after all of that's been going on. The characters are now kind of late teens, early 20s, and basically they've all drifted apart. Oh, she mentioned those characters being teenage inventor Chase Stein, glowy alien girl Carolina Dean, goth witch girl Nico Minoru, and Molly Hayes, precocious, super strong teenager, and everyone's favourite.
Because she is.
She is, bless her. So, yeah, they were the Runaways. They did the whole stuff with the pride and the running away from it. And that, look, I'm going to level. I don't know the Runaways. I've watched, like... most of the first season of the TV series, and I'm sort of into it.
I think the comic told the story better than the TV series, I'll be honest. In the same way that Cloak and Dagger, I think the comics told the story of Cloak and Dagger better than the TV series.
Probably. Anyway, teens, they were part of a super team, then they all drifted apart. But now they got to get the band back together.
Why do they have to get the band back together?
That's because Gertrude Yorks, who was one of the Runaways and died... she's back to life now.
Okay, this is going to need an explanation.
Okay, so Gert, in the original series, she was stabbed and deadified. And this series starts with basically Chase bursting into Nico's apartment, holding a dying Gert in his arms, screaming, "You gotta help." And Nico immediately screaming, "Chase, what have you done?"
Okay.
Basically, it's revealed that Chase managed to build a time machine and he went back to try and prevent Gert's death. But Chase, and like as someone who doesn't really know Chase as a character, I like that this one bit kind of told me all I need to know about him. Chase Stein is a man who had a time machine and still managed to get back too late.
I like that. That does actually say a lot about him.
It does. I really like that. So, he travelled back too late. Gert had already been stabbed. So instead he kind of panicked and just grabbed her and brought her back into the present. And now he needs Nico's help to save her. And kind of this is... issue one is spent just kind of with them trying to save Gert's life. And it basically kind of helps explain, you know, sort of what they both are, what their deals are. Especially Nico, whose abilities I really like. And I'm quite annoyed that this didn't really transfer into the TV show.
Yeah.
So, like I said, she is a witch. She can cast magic spells. But to do that, she uses something called the Staff of One. And that can cast pretty much any spell you can think of. But to cast it, you need to say a word or a phrase. And once you've said that word or phrase, you can never use it again. And I think that's a really neat concept for a power.
It's a great idea, but the thing that always confused me about Nico Minoru's power is that words change their meaning depending on where you are in the world, don't they?
Yeah, but I think the implication is that the staff kind of it can read her mind and like know what it is you want to get out of the spell, but it just needs like a trigger phrase.
That's what I'm saying, you know. I reckon the easiest... This is going to sound like a crazy idea, but I reckon Nico Minoru...
Oh, God, Rob, what now?
No. It's not crazy in a bad way, okay? It's not crazy as in a crazy way. Crazy in a good way. I reckon Nico Minoru is one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe. And the reason I think that is because the Staff of One, you know, as you said, it must have some kind of telepathic link, so it picks up her intention. So that means any word could work.
Oh, yeah. No, that's not crazy. That's literally how it works.
Yeah. So,
which you think would make her overpowered.
Yeah.
But then you've got the idea that she becomes less powerful every time she uses it. And so there's this constant worry of, well, okay, we're in a big fight and I could just use the staff to like make this bad guy disappear. But then what if I need to do that like later on down the line and I can't? And that's the only thing standing between us and failure.
Yeah, and that's what I'm saying. She has actually an easy way to get around that. She just has to make noises. You don't even need language. You just go, yep, and there you go, massive fireball.
See, I figure it doesn't work like that.
Probably doesn't work like that, but, you know, we're talking about comic book science and magic and...
Yeah, but anyway, but yeah, just I love just how it's used in this first issue. Because the idea is Nico, she's just come off being part of A-Force, if you remember that.
Yeah, because I covered that, didn't I?
You did. And the thoughts going through her head is the idea that, obviously, as part of that team, she's had to use a lot of her healing magic, and now she's just kicking herself because she should have saved it for this much more important thing. And so she can't just yell, you know, heal Gert, and, you know, fix her and everything. So it's like you get this whole thing with her yelling doctor in the house and just summoning a random doctor.
That works.
This woman just like appears in the middle of the living room, just like kind of part way through brushing her teeth. She's going, what?
That, like that idea.
Yeah, that's great because it just gets like crazier and crazier.
I mean, the more you describe it, the more it sounds like Nico Minoru's power is more like a monkey's power, isn't it?
Yeah, it like basically she can do anything but can't necessarily control what it is that happens.
Yeah.
Because like it ends up basically with this doctor digging around wearing a pair of X-ray goggles that like Nico's just summoned out of nowhere. And then like in the end they need Gert to basically tell her what the problem is. So she summons a Ouija board like to get Gert's spirit to tell them what the issue is that needs fixing.
Wow.
it's crazy and inventive.
And overly complicated, but I think that's the runaway style these days, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's just like this crazy, fast-paced, madcap adventure. And it's a fantastic first issue to kick things off.
Awesome.
Because, yeah, then the rest of the series goes on. It's basically Gert saying, you know, she refuses to accept that the Runaways have all just drifted apart. and she's going to reunite them. And so they go around kind of visiting each one, kind of trying to get the team back together. And it's a setup that works really well, because it basically lets each issue focus on a separate member of the cast.
Awesome.
And it's really good, because I think it works. If you're a long-time reader, it makes a reference to lots of things that happen. It does such a good job of like kind of summing up not just the Runaways series, but also like all the things they've done in between when they've just all been like running around on their own. Because like they bring up things like A-Force and Avengers Arena that Nico and Chase were both part of.
Yeah.
And like Victor Mancha appears as well. And like they make reference to what happened to him in the Vision series, which, spoiler alert, he maybe died, but actually didn't, and is now just a disembodied head that Chase has to carry around in his backpack.
Yep.
And yeah, so it's lots of great references for if you're a longtime fan, but it also does a really good job sort of laying things out for new readers like me. Because even after like the first two issues, you know, I'm sold on the fact that these characters are a group of friends who've just drifted apart and want to get back together. And I am invested in seeing them, you know, rekindle that friendship.
It sounds like a great read, actually. I'll be honest, it sounds like something that, you know, kind of a fresh take on the whole superhero, supervillain thing. In the way that
it is, because there's not a lot of superhero action, really.
Yeah.
Because it's more kind of family drama, and also a bit of fighting a mad scientist and her psychic cats.
See, aside from the psychic cats, when you said it's like a family drama and fighting a mad scientist, that sounded a bit like, you remember that Maximum Ride? Max Ride?
I do not know.
I covered an issue of it ages ago, but it sounds a bit like Max Ride. Although I think Runaways predates Max Ride.
Probably. Anyway, Runaways is great. And Chris Anker is just, he is always good at art.
That he is.
Especially on something like this, because I feel like one of his main strengths is drawing people not in costumes, but still, like, each character has their own style, and that style is consistent, even, like, across multiple outfits, and says a lot about them.
Yeah.
Like, especially Nico's look, because I like how she's gone from, like, in the art you see in the original Runaways series, and, like, in the TV show, she's this very, like, over-the-top goth with the long black dresses and the sort of pigtails everywhere.
Yeah.
But I like how now you can tell that she's grown up a lot, and now it's a lot more of a subdued style. So it's maybe, like, you know, like a black T-shirt with a check shirt and some black lip gloss. And I think it's one of those things where you can say, okay, yeah, I can see how this character has sort of grown up and matured just in the way that they dress now.
Yeah.
That's a lot of things. I think in superhero comics, characters not wearing their superhero outfits is a thing that lots of artists struggle with.
I mean, again, I'm going to bring it back to Mockingbird, but I think Mockingbird did that really, really well as well. Because Mockingbird was very rarely in that comic, in the miniseries, there were only a couple of issues where she was actually in a uniform, and then there's that first issue where she's wearing different costumes at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, and a lot of her clothes in that. Like, Mockingbird has a very distinct style, and you can see that in all the things she dresses up in.
Yeah. And I like the fact that other comic book writers and artists are actually doing a similar thing. You know, giving these characters their own style, their own, you know, their own taste in clothes and shoes, that sort of thing.
Yeah, it's come a long way, because especially in the 90s...
Oh, please don't.
You would get some incredible... Like, it was literally like the artists had just Googled random clothes and gone, yes, this will be the good basis for an outfit.
Yeah.
Yes, wool knit tights will absolutely go with a dress.
Depends which century you're in.
Ah. I know. What if every male character just wore a sweater vest?
Shall I go on then?
Yep, back to you, back to Venom.
All right, more Venom, but this time with added X-Men. And this is Venom and X-Men, not Venom versus X-Men. Venom and X-Men. Very important you remember that. And this is Poison X by Cullen Bunn with art by Jacopo Carmagni. Is it Carmagni? Might be.
I do not know.
Just so you know, the other Spider-Man, Venom Inc., was by Dan Slott with art by Mike Costa. So anyway, Venom and X-Men. Now, I've got to ask, do you know what the poison is?
Is it tequila?
No, I mean, Marvel's version of the poison, it's this thing from outer space that's a bit like the Venom symbiont and it takes over the host, blah, 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 blah. So the poison has taken over one of the contacts out in space, and so the X-Men...
Okay, cool, but what is it?
What? The poison. It's something that the Venom symbiotes hate. The Venom symbiotes come from the planet Kyra, is it? Something like that. And wherever this thing is, it can do damage to them.
So it's like a worse Venom.
Well, not quite. Basically, it puts a mask over the face and then they're mind-controlled to do someone's bidding. Anyway, Scott Summers is on the phone to his dad, and his dad phones him back, and then all of a sudden aliens attack, and the last thing Scott sees is this black tentacle wrapping around his dad's throat, and then silence. So he's panicking because his dad is some stuff going down, and his dad's right in the middle of it. Are you following so far?
Almost.
Right. The black tentacle is part of a Venom symbiote, because the people who've kidnapped the Starjammers are a group of alien bounty hunters who want to sell the Starjammers to the highest bidder, and they've basically got these weaponized symbiotes from this mercenary who goes to the planet and cleans them out, collects them all, turns them into weapons, and the symbiotes aren't happy. So who better for the X-Men to get involved with this than Venom? And Venom does get involved in this in some rather brutal ways. And that's all I'm going to say on that front, because the rest of it is a spoiler. But anyway, the art is quite good. The storyline is Fruit Loops. I'll be honest, whenever they do these crossovers, it's always going to be Fruit Loops. You have a situation where Jean Grey is now working for the enemy, because there is the third side in this, and third side is the so-called Conqueror of Worlds, that sort of thing. It's a bit of a mess of a story, I'll be honest. It's got far too many characters and far too little time to actually run with any of them. So you find yourself just looking for the sections with Venom in the story.
Yeah, I'm lost already.
I'm lost already as well. You know, you find yourself looking for the sections of the story with Venom in, because they're the most fun. Venom, I don't know how it's worked out, but in the first one, in Venom Inc., Eddie Brock becomes a good guy and even convinces Felicia, the Black Cat, to become a good guy again. In Venom and X-Men, Venom is clearly a good guy who has homicidal tendencies, and it's his symbiote who's telling him to calm down.
Yeah, okay.
That's all I've got to say about that. Make of it what you will, Venom isn't a bad comic book. It's just misunderstood. No, Venom
I hope the Venom movie is less confusing than this.
Yeah, sorry, I should rephrase that. Venom isn't a bad character, he's just misunderstood. I'll get it right. I'm confused, I don't know what's going on.
Third time's the charm.
Yes, Venom is confusing, and you should never read two Venom graphic novels back-to-back about an hour before you're supposed to record a show about them.
Robert Hogue, I'm very disappointed.
All I'm doing is giving people...
That's why I was so disappointed I used your NASA name.
Yes. All I'm saying is... I'm not saying that I did that. I'm saying it's a health warning.
Very suspiciously specific health warning.
Well, let's put it this way. They lose Jean Grey at the end because Jean Grey apparently isn't a powerful enough telepath to fight mind control from some alien parasitic creature that puts a mask over her face.
Oh, well, what a shame. Guess I'll have to kill off all the time-displaced X-Men and never talk about them ever again.
Yeah, they leave her floating in space.
You know, I think I've decided that's now my canonical ending point for those X-Men.
What, floating in space?
Yeah, they went to space and they died. They died on the way back to their home planet.
Maybe they did.
Anyway, back to me, is it?
Yes, because Venom just confused the crap out of me. Tentacles everywhere.
So I've been reading Star Wars Darth Vader by Charles Soule with art by Giuseppe Cameron Coley.
Okay.
What I like about Darth Vader, it's got a plot that's quite easy to explain. So this is a continuing from the series I talked about a little while ago.
Yeah.
It's set just after Revenge of the Sith. So Darth Vader, he's getting used to being Darth Vader. And he's also got a squad called the Inquisitors, who are a bunch of other Jedi who kind of defected from the Order before all the others got shot down by clones.
Okay.
So this book starts it starts with him training the Inquisitors, and I like his training methods. Basically, you just see them all, like, with hands and arms and eyes cut off. And, like, the Grand Inquisitor runs them and saying, like, this isn't training, it's torture. And Darth Vader's just like, I'm teaching them loss. They're not going to forget it.
That's a really good thing to say there. And brutal.
It is. That's our Darth.
Thing is, I'm just imagining that in James Earl Jones's voice.
I think that's why I tend to like Darth Vader series. Because I can just imagine every line in a booming baritone.
Yep.
So anyway, the main plot focuses on Darth Vader as he hunts down Jocasta Nu, who is one of the surviving Jedis.
Okay.
And she's actually quite an interesting character, because the idea is she was the head archivist. It's like she's a Jedi who's very smart and knowledgeable, but also has like no combat training. So it's this big kind of cat and mouse game as Darth Vader chases her around the old Jedi archives, because he's also been instructed to capture her alive so that the Emperor can plumb all her secrets.
Yeah.
He's a, I'm just saying, Palpatine has needs.
Well, if Wrinkly is your way, then, you know, I'm not going to argue.
Anyway, those are the first four issues.
Okay.
And then also two more issues, which are their own like little storyline. You see, Darth Vader goes to another world where he's been told that there's a Jedi, only to be ambushed by bounty hunters. And he discovers that, you know, the ambush was set by someone within the Empire. And I really like how he resolves the situation, which, you know, I like it so much, I'm even going to spoil it.
Okay.
Because first of all, they set up this twist that it was Palpatine that did it. And I think that kind of works because a lot of the first Darth Vader series, which was by Kevin Gillen, that was about kind of Palpatine. I put some death games for Vader as a test.
Yeah.
But then it turns out the order is actually coming from a conspiracy. Like, all the ranking Imperial officers basically said, you know, who the hell even is this Darth Vader guy strutting around giving us orders? We'll show him. And so what he does, because obviously you can't take out, you know, all the Imperials, oh, that's just going to like wreck the Empire. So instead he calls like just everyone into a big room, picks five at random and chokes them to death.
Wow.
And I just love it as this, and that's why you don't mess with me moment.
Wouldn't dream of it.
Yeah, it's a lot of fun. It's just Darth Vader being like ridiculously over the top and badass. Like, I will say though, I still think I don't enjoy it as much as Kieran Gillen's series. Just because that was so very good indeed. And that there's a bit in this of characters. It sometimes seems like Darth Vader isn't necessarily the most competent. It's just that he's the only one who isn't a massive idiot.
Okay.
Like, when they're hunting for Jocasta Nu, like, the Imperials discover the hangar where she's parked her ship. And so she, like, she has her droid set to blow up that ship if it's ever discovered. So that bomb goes off and they're sifting through the wreckage. Like, they find a bit of the ship with the Jedi symbol on it and go, someone must have put this graffiti here to make it look like a Jedi symbol. It must be some damn hoodlums.
I don't know what to say to that kind of logic.
It is one of those things where, like, you just put the book down for a second, place hand on face.
Yes, it is definitely a hand-faced moment, just like that joke of mine.
Yes, it is. Yeah, I like Cameron Corley's art in this, though. It's very clean, very bright. And I also want to give a shout-out to Danielle Orlandini and David Curiel, who are the ink and colourist. Because Cameron Corley's art, I've seen it in a few places. Like, I know he's done a lot of the work on Dan Slott's Spider-Man series, and there I thought, like, it's looked a bit flat. But here, the inks and colours, they make it pop. Like, especially there's just this great recurring scene where Darth Vader's meditating and it sort of goes on to, like, the astral plane or whatever. And it's just this great image. Sort of Darth Vader as this white humanoid figure, but loads of that figure's been just overtaken by, like, this red swirling chaos. It's sort of floating in the middle of a storm. I love that as a representation of Darth Vader's mental state.
See, the mental imagery there really works. It really sells it as well, doesn't it?
Yeah, like, it's good because, like, one of the characters mentions early on that like the dark side, it hasn't just scarred Vader's body, it's scarred his very soul. And I like that they're then going to like actually show you that.
See, I like that as well. I like the fact that they actually are doing the show, not tell bit.
Yeah, it's good. Like, I think when I reviewed the first volume of this, I was kind of a bit lukewarm about it, but
yeah.
But yeah, that I'm really warm to this series now.
Awesome. Awesome. Yeah. So, that's us for this week, isn't it?
Yeah, that's my voice pretty much ruined.
Yep. We are done here. We're going to, you know, drink water and cool down. So until next week, I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening. And yes, it is called the Glory Hole.